Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself a Gun,
a Sopranos podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Sopranos and talk about it. We're very excited for all of you joining us here on the world's only Sopranos podcast. We're the only one that exists. Your weekly reminder to give us 5 stars in a review. Gotten some really great new reviews, Vince. Really great ones. Mm. I won't read them to you because you're looking at me like you're mad. So I won't belabor this process.
End of the show. We could do it at the end of the show. Yep. All right.
Yeah. But anyways.
It's fine. I'm used to it.
Thank you for the 5 stars and the reviews. You guys have been wonderful. All right, ladies and gentlemen. See, that was short. How about that? Mm. You know? Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, today we have a very special guest. You know her podcast because we have had her counterpart, Rachel Fisher, on a couple of times. And today, this is the first time we've had the other half of the Hollywood Crime Scene podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Desi Jedekin.
Hi, I'm really excited to be here. I've been dying to get on the show. So
I've heard from Rachel that you are a Sopranos fan.
That's correct. In fact, I got her to watch The Sopranos. She had not seen it until a few years ago. So I was kind of like, why are you on? What?
Yeah, that is unfair. Yeah, no, the fact that you like incepted her into the Sopranos universe, it does mean that by merit alone, you should have been the first person from your podcast to come on.
It's fine. She had more enthusiasm because she had just watched it probably.
Yeah. She was very excited to be on the podcast, mostly because, yeah, The Sopranos is a good show, which I think we can all agree with. When did you first start watching The Sopranos?
The first time I saw it, because I've watched the series a few times through, was sort of at the end of the run. I had to catch up. And then when the final season, or like part two of the final season was happening, I had caught up and was sort of watching it week to week.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what I tend to do. And then I have to suffer week to week at some point.
It's so not worth it. It's like one of those things I've realized that I will wait until a TV show has long since been spoiled for me before I decide to watch it.
Yeah. I listened to last week's episode and I kind of agree. I can't remember who said it about spoilers. Like, I don't really give a fuck about spoilers. If the show is good, I'll watch it. Like, it doesn't matter to me.
Completely agree.
I mean, if it relies completely on surprise, where like if knowing the surprise ruins the whole show, like that wasn't a good show, because like what is one plot point reveal?
That's kind of how I feel. It doesn't. I mean, sure, it's great if it happens, and I'm not spoiled, but it doesn't really upset me that much.
I like an occasional surprise. Like, there are some things that do. I mean, The Sixth Sense, you know, that was a nice surprise for me.
No, but then you go back, if you know it, like, it actually makes the movie, like, it adds a wrinkle to the movie of stuff that you didn't notice the first time. It doesn't ruin the movie. It adds, like, another dimension to it. I watch The Sopranos episodes, like, twice every time we do the show. And the second time is usually not, like, it doesn't feel like a chore to watch it twice. I'll say that.
Yeah. And knowing who's going to die, knowing who's going to die and who's going to live. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know. You kind of just assume everyone's going to die. That's just, it's a mafia show. Why would you go around? But I can't believe someone from the mafia got killed.
Also, it's like, still really stressful. Like, even when you knew it was going to die, like when I watched it the second time through, I was still fucking stressed, even if I knew exactly what was happening, because it's a good show. Like,
and it gives me the chance to be more emotional about the death that I know is coming. Like, I rewatched Long-Term Parking, which is, you know, that episode. And And knowing what was coming in the episode just made me enjoy it all the more because, you know, I got to enjoy some really good acting.
Well,
I kind of hope that you're going to change it somehow.
I know.
That's me anyway. It's like, maybe it's like abused child syndrome, but I'm always like, I can fix it this time.
Just rewatching it going, yeah. Run, don't get in the car. Silvio's bad.
Haven't you learned anything? Like,
yeah. Like, come on. You haven't learned anything from the last time I watched this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you completely. You know, spoilers are, who cares about spoilers? Did you, what was your reaction then? Because I think we watched it the same way where I didn't start watching it. I watched it when it was on TV, but not to like season 6 or 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And I, because I think I was in college at the time, which is a euphemism for I was drunk.
Yeah.
I had a very strong, angry reaction to the ending of The Sopranos. What was your feeling?
Well, here's the thing. I didn't watch it when it aired. So by the time I watched it, because I typically, well, I don't know why I didn't watch it, but for some reason I couldn't. So then I already had heard some of the reaction before I saw it. I think I heard about people thinking their cable went out or something
right.
like that. Like,
mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know that I heard, there wasn't theories at that point. It was kind of like the cable thing was happening, I think. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went into it knowing that. And I think it made me less angry because I was like, well, I'm going to be the one who's a calm adult here. Like,
right, right. Yeah. You lucked out.
People like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm very big about like, you know, like how I, like the audience, you know, if people talk about something a lot and they put it really highly up, I'll go into it with a very negative attitude. But same. If everyone hates it, I'll go into it with like, I'm going to see what's really going on here. Like, I'm very affected by that kind of like the talk or the water cooler talk.
Right.
Well, plus,
right.
Yeah. It's just enjoyable when the creator says, fuck you. You know, like when it's art that says, fuck you, I like to appreciate it because, you know, I feel like most people need to be told that.
Because you agree, because you're like, yeah, fuck me. I am a pig.
Exactly.
We don't deserve this show.
Right. Exactly. I don't deserve
anything. Treat us like the slugs that we are.
Yeah,
exactly. Please pour salt on us and watch us bubble. We are disgusting.
Yeah, I never had like a negative reaction to it. And then I feel like I like it more as time has gone on.
Yeah.
I mostly feel sad. I think I'm more affected by James Gandolfini.
Yeah,
because I'm kind of like, wait, like that affects me more than the ending of The Sopranos, because I was like, well, we're really not going to have that again, so it made it more final to me or something. Like, I don't know.
that the ultimate spoiler is death. If you think about it, sometimes I say really profound things on this podcast. If someone could please put that on a t-shirt, because
coffee table book of Matt Liebisms. I mean, you are wearing a shirt that has one of your own quotes on it today, Matt.
I am wearing my own merch right now. It's laundry day, and this is all I wearing a shirt that just says "How come" on it with a guy screaming with bloody arms. It's a don't worry about it, Desi. It's a bit that I do when I do stand up.
Okay.
But this is not a podcast about me doing stand up. This is a podcast about The Sopranos, and as you all know, we cannot start this podcast until we have all heard the theme song. Pod. Yourself again. Your mama always said you'd be the chosen pod. Pod. You got to burn the shine. You're born under a podcast. Blue moon in your eyes. Pod. 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 Podcast. All righty, everybody. Today, we are talking about from season 4 of The Sopranos, episode 12. Eloise is the name of the episode, and this episode premiered December 1st, 2002. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
Oh, I sure can. That's a synopsis that goes something like, Carmela and Furio grow too close for safety, while Polly discovers that he's not as big a fish as he thought he was.
I love that they did Too Close for Safety, but not Comfort.
Mm.
They bailed on the cliche.
That's right.
Because the writer was like, no, we're going to go for something original here. Yeah. So that's some of the things that happened in the episode. IMDb is not great with synopses. But Vince, what was happening at the time that this episode aired?
That's right. We're going to take a little trip in the Remember When machine all the way back to December 1st, 2002.
Walk, walk. Teddy, daddy, bop, bop, shoo, bop. Remember then.
Remember when it's the lowest form of conversation.
Yeah, a lot of things happening this week back in 2002. Well, first of all, you know, Bobby Bacala, a.k.a. Steve Shirupa, he has written a book called The Goomba's Guide to Life. And he's got a write-up in the New York Post about it on this day in 2002.
Wow.
Soprano star Steve Shirupa says he's stunned at the success of his book, A Goomba's Guide to Life, which he co-wrote with Charles Fleming and which was ranked 178 on Amazon.com as of late Friday. I knew it was pretty funny, good. But I didn't know if it would catch on, says Shirupa, who plays Uncle Junior's driver enforcer, Bobby Bacala, on the series. I thought people would think the book was a Goomba pamphlet, but it's my guide to life and how I got through it, Shirupa said. I had Michael Imperioli and Tony Sirico, who's the ultimate Goomba, read the galleys. And when Tony gave me the thumbs up, I knew that was it.
So is this a self-help book for like...
Oh, just wait. Hold on. Uh-huh. I'm cracking a stereotype here, showing that a Goomba is more of an attitude, he said. He's a guy who loves his family and friends and isn't a gangster.
What? I love it. He's kind of, I like that he's reclaiming it. It's like, no, this is our word. Yeah. And yeah, this is the G word.
This is a guy who loves family, is not a gangster, and dresses nicely.
He's an early proponent of anti-Italian, going against the anti-Italian racism or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. He's like the first, I think it's called the Antipasta Defamation League.
Yeah, that's right.
And he definitely is like, listen, a Goomba is less of a thing where you're, you know, a gangster and you're killing people. It's more of a, like when you hear your family, you know, it's one of those things. I do love his reclamation of the word to mean something as vague as it means when you love your family.
Yeah, no, it's only Goombas that do that.
Mm-hmm, that's it. I mean, you know, congrats to him for, being an author, published author, Steve Shirupa.
I mean, technically a co-author of the number 178 most popular book on Amazon.com.
Does that mean, like, does that count as a bestseller? Did he get New York Times?
He was not on the bestseller list as of not in the top 10. I looked this week and it wasn't in there. Uh-oh. But
Amazon was around back then. I think he would have been at the top of some list probably.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, unfortunately,
like at the top of the Goomba's Guide to Gifts for dads and grads. I guess this was right before Christmas, so you know.
Yeah, no, it is a perfect, that's like the exact type of Christmas gift that you get to your large son
who, yeah, it's a like, stocking stuffer that goes right under like a jar of sauce.
Yeah exactly.
Wow.
It's okay, he could say that his last name is Mancini.
Oh, I got it.
He's all out.
Yeah, so a lot of things, other things that were happening this week, and other big news, this was the week that they sent Central Park 5 were cleared by new DNA test evidence.
Oh wow. That's insane. I forgot it was like 2002.
Yeah, more than a decade later, the official view of those words has taken a sharp turn. The Manhattan District Attorney Robert M. Morgenthau has signaled that he is likely to join defense lawyers on Thursday in asking a judge to vacate the conviction. Mr. Morgenthau...
Oh, how magnanimous. Yeah. How magnanimous of the cops to be like, fine, you've gotten all of the evidence that exists.
Yeah. Oh, well, it gets better. Mr. Morgenthau declined to be interviewed last week. He said in October that he had been surprised by evidence that emerged in the last year. The new evidence includes a claim by Matias Reyes, a convicted murderer and serial rapist, that he alone attacked the jogger. DNA tests not only proved his involvement, but also showed that physical evidence had been wrongly used at two trials in 1990 to implicate the five teenagers.
Fake planted evidence. I mean, it's like, oh, God. Yeah.
Other former and current law enforcement officials, including police detectives and Linda Fairstein, the chief of the sex crimes unit who oversaw the prosecution when she was a member of the district attorney's office, continue to hold that the teenagers managed to have some contact with the jogger and perhaps ran the jogger off the path, starting the assault that Mr. Reyes finished.
I'm not a religious person, but I only like, I don't care if there's a heaven. I really need there to be a hell. Like, I would really love if there were a hell, because some people really do need at least 1,000 years of burning in flames. That is, I mean, the thing about The Sopranos, to tie it in, which I rarely do.
I like when you digress. Anyway, speaking of hoping that certain people burn in hell for 1,000 years.
Well, the thing about
The Sopranos.
I am watching it, rewatching it. And as I've gotten older, every rewatch, the tactics of the FBI and law enforcement become more and more just they're almost Nerf compared to real life. You know what I mean? Yeah. You watching them carelessly entrap people who are definitely going to die, and try to make informants out of people who don't know shit. And just all they do is put people's lives in danger. I remember that being really profound at the time when I first watched it, cops doing crooked shit. But now, I don't know, as I've gotten even older, I'm just the Sopranos didn't go hard enough on the cops, because real prosecutors, real cops, real feds are literally the devil. And
why we have the mayor of Easttown. They showed her planting those drugs on her stepdaughter.
I don't know what that is.
Daughter-in-law. She's trying to get custody. You don't know what the mayor of Easttown is?
Is that a new show?
Do you even watch prestige TV, bro?
I watch The Sopranos.
Well, show some love for Kate Winslet.
It's the show everyone's watching because there's nothing else on, basically.
Yeah.
Is it the show
to the Wawa to get some water and stuff like that, dude?
Is it the one that is Mare, M-A-R-E?
Yeah, her name's Mare.
Oh, yeah. I saw everyone online talking about mare, and I was just like, I don't know what mare is, but I know it's a horse of some sort, so I don't want to watch a horse show.
Yeah, it's not about horses.
It's not a horse
show?
It's
about Kate Winslet. She's a cop who doesn't play by the rules anymore.
Oh, that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I like it.
Well, if you thought the article about the Central Park Five was gross... this was also the week that People magazine named Donald...
Jeffrey Epstein. Go ahead.
Named Donald Rumsfeld, quote, sexiest cabinet member.
Jesus Christ.
This is a real article. CNN called him a virtual rock star. Fox dubbed him a beltway babe magnet. And the Wall Street Journal hailed the new hunk of home front airtime. No, it's not the next Brad Pitt. The guy causing the commotion is 70-year-old grandfather of five, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Rumstud, as President Bush refers to his front man.
As we all refer to him, Rumstud. It's a good pun, and it describes him perfectly.
God. With his worn brown shoes and rumpled gray suits, has put a new spin on Henry Kissinger's maxim, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
God, this is honestly, who was this, a David Frum piece? Did he do a feature for People real quick?
I don't think it had a byline.
There's nothing sexier than Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger in the same fucking sentence.
They had to pick someone from the Bush administration. Why even go there?
Yeah. I mean, we're about to, go to Iraq. I love that even People magazine is trying to manufacture consent. They are all right, we all got to get on board, all of the
They're
media get
manufacturing
together.
Manufacturing a lot of different types of consent here, which is... with blunt talk and wry humor, Mr. Secretary has become the Pentagon's very own must-see TV. More than any other man in Washington, says Barbara Starr, CNN's Pentagon correspondent, Donald Rumsfeld exercises absolute raw, ruthless power and enjoys it. On the flip side, she adds, Rummy can be a, quote, a big flirty pussycat. Happily married to his high school sweetheart, Joyce, 70, the 5'10 bespectacled father of three has proven his mettle under pressure. On 9/11, while most senior officers were running for cover, Rumsfeld was outside the Pentagon carrying stretchers.
Furiously masturbating and planting evidence. I'm just kidding.
The ex-Navy pilot is an old-fashioned all-American He-Man, plain and simple, says Jennifer Harper, media columnist for the Washington Times. He's got that steady gaze, that strong jaw. A man you could trust if all hell were breaking loose. That's pretty sexy stuff.
Jesus Christ, dude. At least pick like John Ashcroft. He could sing.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's where we were in 2002. Our moral compass was just rotting right off, right?
Fucking
before
A.
our very eyes.
Real, real top shelf disgusting shit today, Vince.
Hey, that was what was happening. What can I say?
Yeah. Yeah. That is,
thank God we had the Sopranos.
Thank God. Seriously. That was all that was the only good thing happening in America. So what else happened?
I mean, that's basically it. The movies and the songs are the same as last week. We don't need to. This is Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Die Another Day, Santa Claus 2. A couple months that premiered were Treasure Planet, which was a Disney animated movie about Treasure Island set in space, which I did.
Yeah.
I completely memory hold that one.
Yeah. Yeah. It flopped like fantastically. And there was apparently it's actually really good, but just no one wanted to see it. Or 9/11 happened and they really didn't want to see a movie about a treasure planet.
And Eight Crazy Nights by Adam Sandler. Those debuted at 4 and 5. So, they weren't doing
great.
Super great. And Eminem still at the top of the charts with Lose Yourself.
Hell yeah.
You're Right by Nirvana. And that was the Remember When machine.
All right. Well, that was the Remember When machine. And now we got to get into this episode. As Vince said earlier, the synopsis is Carmel and Furio grow too close for safety, and Polly discovers he's not as big of a fish as he thought he was. Boring stuff, which is why I have the Bada B stories for you that will really go into depth explaining all of the storylines in the episode.
Oh, I can't
wait. Apologies up front.
I like, they're always better when you apologize first.
God. Young AJ, he's reading an essay on Billy Budd. Polly's mom keeps talking, makes Minnie crash her car. Furio hears Tony call Carmen a full name. He's angry and almost pushes Tony into helicopter blades.
You're standing too close.
Only two verses, don't worry.
I love you. I want you to be my wife. You help my mamma mia pick up the best floor tiles. I leave the country, go back to Italia. Your daughter, she in love with the man who fixed the team. You're standing.
Time well spent, Matt. Time well spent.
I did three-part harmonies on that one, you guys.
Yeah, that's high. I've tried to sing along to Sting when I've been in the car, and I'm glad that no one was there to hear it, because it's way
I almost lost my voice just trying to record that. but the reason I picked that song, other than the obvious reasons of him saying standing too close, is to me, this episode is purely about people standing too close in a metaphorical sense.
Oh, go on.
Like in an art type of way.
Yeah.
So like you've got Furio is too close to Carm, and he knows it. Meanwhile, obviously Carm is also too close to Furio. Polly is too close to Johnny Sack. And Johnny Sack is too close to Tony, according to Little Carmine. Little Carmine is too close to his father. Tony is too close to those helicopter blades. Mm. He's also, if you'll, you know, bear with me for a second. This is really profound. He's too close to his ego, because he just can't see past the fact that he doesn't understand that anyone could cheat on him. He can't even picture it in his mind. And then of course there's AJ, who's obviously one step closer to the edge and he's about to break. But yeah, that to me, that's what the episode is about. People, blinded by their friendships and feelings for, one another.
Yeah.
And Min is too close to the dinner rolls.
Yes. Min was way too close to those dinner rolls and stole them directly from, Nucci, apparently. Yeah, and then, you know, I don't know. To me, this episode is mostly, I'm not going to say a filler episode. It's not like, it doesn't feel like the standard filler. It is really kind of like an abrupt arc closing episode for Furio and Carmella.
Which I was happy for. Like, I felt like they took that storyline as far as it could go without them, you know, having sex, and it was kind of getting tiresome after like three episodes of them, you know, mooning over each other and not doing anything about it. Like you have to either shit or get off the pot. And so they sent him back to Italy, which, I mean, makes me sad to lose Furio, but I am not sad to lose the Furio Carm storyline.
Oh, I love it.
You do? I hate Furio. To me, Furio is like the Fabio of the Sopranos universe.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get why Carmella likes him at all. Like, I don't get the appeal. I am more attracted to like the Tony type. I'm admitting that I am fucked up. I am glad the storyline is over. But to me, this episode is kind of just setting up Whitecaps.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's definitely there to set up what's coming.
Yeah,
for sure. And wrapping up the Furio is essential to that, I think.
I mean, yeah. Like, I think we said this on another episode, but like Furio was a very good character at the beginning when he's like this nice, kind of affable, like Italian meathead who bursts all the Italian guys' bubble by being like exotic and weird to them. But then when they turned him into, like you said, basically the Fabio of the Sopranos, it was kind of like, all right. This guy was much better when he was like murdering people, and then
because it was a contrast to that kind of dorky European
Maron, it smells like a heaven in here.
I fucked up your face. You know.
The Carmella thing brought out this softer side that I was just not into. I'm like, I didn't want it.
Yeah,
I agree. When he's
like a sociopathic murderer in a glorious, gloriously tacky silk shirt, that's pretty awesome. But when he's just like a fuckboy in a silk shirt, you're like, well, that's just kind of like standard fuckboy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they turned him into like some guy on the cover of a romance novel for sure.
Right.
And
it appeals to like middle-aged women, I think, like that type of guy for sure. They're kind of safe, like in a way.
And I think for me, what I like about the storyline a lot, because I do agree with you that it definitely is he's a far cry from who he was when he was introduced.
Yeah.
Actually, for example, like in this very episode, when he's watching Tony like cheating on Carm, and there's a woman next to him who's like, "Do you want to go upstairs with me?" Like, my expectation for that, like, interaction was for him to be like, "Fuck you, you're a whore," or something like that. But he was just like,
"Your expectation was for him to turn into a Russian all of a sudden?"
Yeah.
I can't do a perfect accent. Fuck you, you's a whore. You know, I can't. But yeah, but instead he's just like, he's very like, no, it's okay. But what I enjoy about it is it's specifically for Carmela Soprano's story, which is like that she's so good at reacting to the situations that her feelings have put her into, you know, like she's, the way she reacts isn't, it isn't just like, oh, I'm like in love and she's like floating on a cloud and whatnot. It's more nuanced than that, because her anger when he leaves in this episode, she just takes out on everyone else. And it just like, it gives Edie Falco a chance to really, I don't know, delve into this character of the suburban mafia wife.
Well, and she also doesn't get the chance to like twist the knife into her daughter very often. And yes. And you can, and like in this episode when they're going back and forth, you know, you can tell like, oh yeah, she can definitely put you in your place if she wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, yeah,
it's a great Carmela episode because she really gets to play opposite of what she's feeling inside almost the whole episode.
It's yes.
so contained, but we kind yeah. of see her rage almost throughout. Like once Furio leaves, she's yes. just angry about everything that's not Furio. But it's yeah. all about that, which I think is like more about her ticket out than Furio even. It's mm-hmm. like,
yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. It is definitely her ticket out, even though it's like to any like rational observer, you're like, you're just trading one mafioso for another. Like, it's insane.
But that's who she runs into. Like yeah. the only other person was like the priest before, right? It's like, yeah. and none of these relationships are viable if she left Tony for them.
Right.
It wouldn't even be a possibility. Like,
yeah,
yeah, but yeah. he's a mafioso that appreciates the smell of the olives on a nice summer yeah. day while he's, you know, digging a trench in his grandfather's a yard or whatever.
And
they'd
and
have to do like a Michael Corleone and like move back to the old country together or something. Mm-hmm. But never
yeah, late, I do but, think. Yeah.
And then she'd be like, God, I'm so fucking tired of him always digging up a handful of rich soil and asking me to smell how fertile it is. If he does that one more time, yeah. I swear to God. I'm yeah.
I don't know the difference between fertile soil and dirt. Why are you making me smell it? But yeah, it definitely like makes it so that Carmela's storyline and like emotional arc in this episode is the most compelling thing, and I think that's why I love this relationship.
You think you think the Carmela story arc is the most compelling in this episode?
No, the most compelling that she has been
in
this relationship, because like before it was definitely kind of this back and forth and like talking with Ro and I don't know what's gonna happen. In this one, just the sudden like going from they have a date set up
yeah.
To he's left the country is fucking crazy. And I have a clip of the very first scene we see with Furio finally entering the house after like 2 weeks of deciding to not come in for random reasons.
The entire point of Melville's Billy Budd, it seems to me, is to show how mean humans can be to each other, especially when living in cramped conditions.
Well, hold that thought. Come on in. So how is your mother's apartment coming?
Ari's uncle Zio finished the framing, but now the Chirac is wet on the bottom. There's a leak maybe in the foundation.
My father is a contractor. If you want, I can have him take a look at it. He is free, I think, tomorrow afternoon.
That would be a huge relief. What smells in this house? Maron, it's like the smell of heaven.
Homemade scones. My son loves them.
Well, that's all there is for breakfast, is fat and carbs.
Excuse me, Maron. We have a guest. Do you think you might say hello?
Anyway.
It's like the smell of heaven. Like, I mean, I love that he's laying it on thick. And
he's like, I go to a sleep with the fish and I wake up in the sky with the heaven. All of a sudden, why it smell like a scone?
So later in that scene, you know, because like Carmen and Furio are vibing, and I don't know, maybe I'm just a shill for love, but I love to see people like flirting and vibing with each other and then have it completely crash down when Tony shows up.
I think I think the compelling thing about that scene was just the scone politics, where like Karma's made these scones, and you know, she's like obviously trying to use them to like woo Furio with. And then AJ turns him down because he's trying not to get fat. And then Furio turns him down. And then the only person who wants a scone is Tony, who comes in, takes one bite of it, and like gives her like a look, like, "Hey, pretty good, huh?" And then puts it down. And then and that's all she got out of making those fucking scones.
Yeah, I love the contrast where it's like when you get into a relationship where you start hating everything about them. Like, she's so repulsed by Tony, and I was repulsed by him eating that scone too. I was like, "You motherfucker!" Like, yeah. Just the way he ate it and then put it back down on the plate like a fucking pig. It was just, you could sense her rage at the whole scene of it. Like, it was so funny to me. Tony's very funny to me.
Yeah, like, "Hey, it's great job doing that wife stuff here in the kitchen." You know,
really trying, and it's just so. She doesn't want it at all. Like,
hey, look, you're exactly where you belong.
You did a good job, and now you got a pat on the head like a good woman.
Like a good dog. Yeah, I mean, but I think that's why I love the Furio Karm stuff so much, is because of the fact that, like, you've got Tony and his, like, weird traditionalism, where he's just stoked that his wife is, you know, like, cooking and stuff, and obviously wetting his beak on the scones, and you've got this kind of, like, unspoken little secret between Carmela and Furio, and Tony literally has no idea, not a clue, to the point where he's like, I think, you know, he gets them two tickets to Paradise or wherever, and then he's just like,
"Pack your bags, we leave tonight," like, literally.
Yeah, like, literally. And then fucking, you know, he says, like, "Listen, I think you need to get away. I think that's probably why you changed your hair." And it's like, fucking, hey, dude, you really have no clue.
Right. None. And that continues to the end. He just doesn't get it. Like, we'll get to that later, but.
That was such a great moment, because you could tell it was like him mustering all the empathy that he could in his body, because he's like, he's trying to use the tricks he's learned in psychoanalysis to understand Karm, and he's just like, "Yeah, that's probably why you cut your hair." And he's like, "Wow, dude.
Notice her hair."
Notice her hair and try to, you know, divine the reason why she changed it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at this point, you'd figure he'd learn at least some psychoanalysis just by osmosis alone. Yeah. But, you know, for him, I think it's because it just literally doesn't enter into his mind, because he's too much of an egomaniac.
So that, I mean, that's like one of the better. There's a lot of great scenes in this episode, and some bad ones too. Like, I think the scene between Johnny Sack, Carmine, and Carmine's son at the golf course is like one of the worst scenes that I've seen on The Sopranos. It's like they're trying to do so many different things in the middle of that scene. Like, they're trying to differentiate, like, Carmine Jr.'s motives from Carmine and Johnny Sack's. They're all trying to play each other in this, like, 10-second scene. Meanwhile, they're trying to do, like, casual golf stuff. And it comes off, I don't know, it was just a bad scene. Like, they're trying to do 20 different things and the scene doesn't breathe.
Home that little Carmine is jealous, basically.
Yeah,
right,
in such
right.
a ham-fisted way. And then Big Carmine, or whatever the fuck his name is.
His name is Big Carmine.
Yeah, starts hitting things with the golf club. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, well, it's like, first of all, we don't really need Carmine Jr. to be jealous of Tony. That's sort of just like a wasted storyline with no payoff. So, like, they're trying to establish something that's unnecessary, and then they do, like, the weird golf stuff. Like, we don't see Johnny Sack hit the ball, but we see him react to hitting the ball for some reason.
So weird. He randomly, in the middle of this, like, of little Carmine blowing up the negotiation because he's jealous for no reason, he just goes, "Oh, what, are they resawed that green?"
Yeah, it's clearly like he hit a bad shot.
People never played golf before wrote this scene and thought maybe someone there would have known.
Yeah, I think he originally hit a shot there and they cut it out for time, but they left the reaction for some reason, and it was like, why? How are you having him react to a shot that we didn't see and no reason? And then Carmine is pissed about his golf shot like 3 minutes after he hit for whatever reason. And he, like,
right. Yeah. Well, he gets a mulligan, you know?
A mulligan, yeah.
He got a mulligan. He hit it. Then Johnny Sack hit it. Johnny Sack reacted to his own ball. And then Carmine smashed his club against the ball washer for some reason. Like, a super delayed reaction.
It's like they just wanted to, they found a really clunky way of throwing a wrench into the negotiation and kind of prolonging this storyline. I mean, really, that storyline is only useful in leading to the end of the episode,
right,
in which Johnny Sack makes it abundantly clear that he wants to take out Carmine.
Yeah, yeah, like Johnny Sack's motive had a payoff and it was clear there, but like Carmine Jr. is just in that scene to drop malapropisms and and then have like four changes of emotion in like 10 seconds.
To be fair though, everything that Lil Carmine says ever in The Sopranos is gold and I love it.
Yeah.
I love that he is like,
I thought it was a little creaky this time, a little creakier than last time.
Nah, I love all like malapropisms. By the way, is it malaprop or malaprop?
I think it's malapropism, I believe.
That's how I've heard it, but then I heard someone say malaprop, and I was like, oh fuck, maybe we've been saying it wrong this whole time. But like I like at one point he goes, he's an old fashioned guy, very allegorical. You know, I'm not really entirely sure what they meant to do there. But I just love when he gets words wrong. Man after my own heart. But yeah, moving on. I mean, that storyline in general is just it's just a long build up to get to Johnny Sack wanting to murder Big Carmine.
Oh, I have some trivia though that I've never pointed out before as we've talked about Carmine, I don't think.
Oh, which yeah, please.
Is that you know, Carmine is played by what's his name? Lip. Tony Lip. And
Tony Lip. Tony yeah, the Lip?
Tony Lip. Who was the driver for the classical pianist Don Shirley, which was the basis for Green Book, which was which was written by Carmine's actual son, Nick Vallelonga.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's there we go.
He was the one who taught that pianist how to eat fried chicken in the car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He taught him, you know, what it means to be a black man in America. low-key though, I really enjoy that movie. There's just something about it.
Here's the thing, that was a movie that the only thing offensive about it was that it was up for awards. Like if you just saw that movie and you're like, oh, this is a Peter Farrelly movie, you'd be like, oh, that was a fine Peter Farrelly movie. But then the minute someone's like, hey, let's give it Best Picture, you're like, wait, what? No.
Yeah, like whoa, what are we doing here? This is too far, guys, too far. Well, that is interesting bit of trivia. But getting back to what's happening with Carmella at this time. Carmella has this scene with Furio in which they you feel like, okay, this is it. This is finally them. They're going to hook up or they're going to kiss or whatnot. Because we've had multiple scenes now in which they've gotten like real close and then someone is like, interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
But then they just decide to do that again in this scene. And I feel like this was, I think for me, when I first saw it, I was like, I think we're closing the book on this whole thing because you're only watching as Furio gets more and more angry at Tony. You know, Tony's in the car with him right after the scene where they, where she doesn't want the tickets for some reason. And calls her a moody bitch.
Yeah.
And Furio's like has this look on his face, like, I don't know, but like maybe you guys aren't attracted to him, but I think he's like, it was kind of hot. Like I was like, oh yeah, defend her honor, dude. That's fucking sick.
You think he would have been hotter if he did kill Tony? Like that.
Yeah.
Was- yeah.
And the closest that we got to him being, you know, as hot as I wanted him to be. And also it would have been consistent with the character that they've been fucking writing for the last few seasons, is the scene where he almost pushes him into a blade of, a propeller blade. He last minute decides not to do it, which I don't know. It was the perfect crime.
Speaking of bad scenes in this episode, I think, you know, the episode evens out after those couple bad ones at the beginning. But, you know, you got Brian Camerata being like the worst drunk actor ever before. And then the next thing you know, you got two guys deciding to take a pee like in the wash of a helicopter. Like, is there a worse place to try to go for a piss? And also,
I that's what I kept thinking of the whole time. And I don't know about physics, but I was like, wouldn't that just like spray all over?
Yeah, like their piss would be going all over each other. They're still
By the blade, no matter how drunk you were.
It depends on what side of the blade. On one side of the blade, like, it'll definitely blow into your face, but on the other side of the blade, it'll pull the pee out.
Well, that was the thing. Like, if that was what was happening, they should have had him, you know, comment on it somehow. Like, oh, look at that stream, or, you know.
Yeah.
The other way, like.
Yeah. I'm setting the world record over here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is strange. I mean, for me, it's like, you know, it's worth it for he's just a regurge. I like when he says regurge. And I also you know, I liked him like looking at all the pieces, seeing the perfect crime taking place. The only thing I didn't like is that like he didn't push him in, because like I think that would have been consistent. That would have been the most consistent thing, crime of passion and whatnot. Of course, it also would have ended the show, so I could see how that'd be a problem.
Maybe Tony like trips on a rock behind him, and then Furio goes head first into the blade, and then instead of going back to Italy, he gets decapitated by a helicopter blade.
Low key, that actually works just as good. And that maybe is something that should have happened, because you know, Tony is too drunk to remember that Furio tried to kill him. You know, he's like, he hasn't put the pieces together because he's drunk or whatnot, and so like he just kind of goes on. The same thing could have happened. He's like, oh, somehow Furio tripped on me, and then like fell into a helicopter blade. Actually, he may have even saved my life. Then Carm could have still been mad, still blame Tony, still been depressed and all that stuff, we would have had a loose end nice and tied up. But no, they, you know, Vince, the problem is you weren't on the writing staff.
Well, plus they like loose ends are part of the Sopranos charm to some degree. Like, that's the true idea that you never know when the Russians are going to come back, you never know when Furio is going to come back from Italy. Yeah. You know, they'd like to have those wild cards up their sleeve just in case, and I appreciate that.
Add some tension.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
But yeah, so this all leads to, you know, Carmela kind of finding out randomly from a friend at church that Furio has put his house on the market.
Furio and Gunther, which was one of my favorite lines of the... Who's that guy you sent over? Furio Gunther? I like the idea that this woman who's lived in Jersey her whole fucking life and every single person that she comes into contact with has like a super Italian name, but she couldn't pronounce Giunta.
Yeah. Yeah. I did wonder, like I it was so wrong that I forgot what his last name was, and I had to look it up, and I was like, oh shit, how did she fuck that one up? But I think it was just supposed to speak to the fact that, like, this obviously all happened really rapidly, like so rapid. Oh, yeah. She didn't even remember the name.
Yeah, she's from Jersey. I believed it.
What was nothing to this woman was everything to Carmela, and it was just tossed off. This information was tossed off to her meaninglessly. Like,
right?
Yeah.
Just completely devastated by it.
Yeah, it's completely devastated, and you know,
not gonna live here anymore. Anyway.
Not gonna live here anymore. And yeah, so it causes her to kind of spiral, and she goes from earlier having seen with Meadow in which they both like sigh about love and like that scene to me. I mean, you know, I feel like we're only talking about the bad scenes, and I feel like, don't worry, we're getting to the good scenes.
Right.
But there was that scene where
I think Meadow, the scone scene was brilliant, I think.
That's very true. But Meadow is with Carmela and talking about Finn, and Meadow says, some men just need to go at their own pace. Mm-hmm. And then there's this pause, and Meadow says, it's amazing, isn't it?
Some men have to move at their own pace, Med.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And I have no idea what she's talking about. Is she talking about men going at their own? It just felt like such a non sequitur. Or were they looking at a juggler or something nearby?
It was
anyone.
I don't know.
It was weirdly timed. Like if she would have said it right after, and not waited. The pause is what throws you off.
The pause ruined it.
Yeah,
yeah. The pause is the thing that I was like, what? Why? I don't understand it.
I also like the name, excellent soprano's name, Finn DiTrullio, because they love doing that with all the people, all the characters of Meadow's generation. They like try to give them the waspiest names. So, you know, yes. Meadow, soprano, Finn DiTrullio.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. And he's like the perfect, you know, avatar for like fourth generation Italian whose family has gone straight and been successful.
And yeah, and so we get to learn a little bit more about Meadow's living situation in Colombia, and it all leads to this this dinner scene, which is I think my favorite in the episode, in which a discussion of Billy Budd takes place with AJ Soprano.
Did you like Billy Budd?
It was okay. You know, my teacher says it's a gay book.
Oh, that is ridiculous.
I've heard that before.
That was written when? The 19th century?
Yeah, I didn't even know they had fags back then.
AJ.
No offense.
I'm not gay.
You're not?
No.
This stuff is pervading our educational system, not to mention movies, TV shows.
What stuff?
This gay nonsense they're teaching. I am sorry, but Billy Budd is not a homosexual book.
Actually, it is, Mother.
I saw the movie, Meadow, with Terrence Stamp.
Terrence Stamp was in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
I don't know about that. But Billy Budd is the story of an innocent sailor being picked on by an evil boss.
Who's picking on him out of self-loathing caused by homosexual feelings in a military context.
Oh, please.
Okay.
Well, what's the difference, huh?
I'm just saying it's ridiculous how everything is being sold as homosexual nowadays.
Leslie Fiedler has written extensively on gay themes in literature since the early 60s. Billy Budd in particular.
Well, she doesn't know what she's talking about.
She's a he mother, and he's lectured at Columbia, as a matter of fact.
Well, maybe he's gay. You ever thought of that?
It just goes to show, you know, moms, they really only start worrying about, like, think of the children when they're not getting any, and they're, as soon as their potential lovers move back to Italy, then it's all about, you know, all this, all this trying to recruit my kids kind of stuff.
Well, she's clearly made, Furio, Billy Budd. she can't have them being attracted to each other.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like he reads as gay, I think, in kind of an American way, you know what I mean? Like he's a svelte, lean Italian man with long hair. Which in America, you know, is like
very brightly colored silk shirts.
Yeah, if you're not gay, you're Italian. You know, it's like it's one or the other. And so I do think there's part of her that is defensive of Billy Budd because Billy Budd is just Furio.
And yeah.
And like the mean boss is Tony. And this idea that like it would even be possible that he's that Furio's gay, just like, because like it's entering her mind. It must enter her mind. The fact that like he just ran off, like maybe he was gay or
like he didn't stay for the color tile date, like
yeah.
I mean, that maybe that would mean he was gay, like if he was more into the decorating.
That's true. It was very confusing for Carm, you know.
She's got a lot going on with that.
She's got
Tony, I like that Tony's kind of the better ally in this scene. And he's like really funny and charming, like everyone clearly likes him. He's making jokes and like and she's just off the rails annoying, like,
or yeah,
over the top, like she's clearly dealing with some anger issues here.
Right. Yeah. He's found his place to be someone who is like trying to defuse this like tense situation that's like tense for no reason. And he's just like, hey, you know, so what if it's gay? Live and let live. Gob and let ghoul.
Yeah.
You know? And like he's it's nice to, I always love seeing Tony in that kind of situation where he's not the one who's emotional and he's not the one who's like acting completely on like pure impulse.
And it probably infuriates Carmela even more to see everyone liking him. Like it's like, no, he's the fucking problem, not me. Like,
And she's also you know, punishing Meadow the same way that she was punished. You know, when no one ate her scones, she's somehow like internalized the anger and refuses to eat like any of the chicken cacciatore or any of the food Meadow has prepared.
Yeah. And also like just on a, I don't know, on a pure like writing tip, like the everything that she says in that scene, the way that Carmela is written and acted is fucking pitch perfect. It's so fun, like, you know, oh, you know, this actor was in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and she goes, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
like that is the perfect response. That is like like a page taken out of like real Italian suburban mom life. It just felt so real.
That reminded me of when I was 18 and when I just turned 18 and we were trying to buy the cigarettes after midnight and the clerk was adamant that it wasn't my birthday yet because it wasn't the next day yet, even though it was after midnight. And she did the, well, I don't know about that. My shift starts at 7 a.m. So.
Yeah. And you're like trying to like speak logically. He's like, no, you don't need to know about that. Yeah. That's a fact.
That's exactly what I said. Didn't go over well.
You didn't get those cigarettes.
Nope, did not. Not from her.
But yeah, then you've also got just kind of like the retort of, you know, Leslie is a man. He's like, well, maybe he's gay. You ever thought about that? And it's like, well, chances are he is. And no one cares at this dinner table. It's so funny. Meanwhile, Meadow is also, again, they write these like, I don't know, like upper middle class adolescent
asshole
liberals.
College students.
Yeah, perfectly. Because like, she's doing like the perfect, like, actually, that is what's happening. And I feel like the actually has kind of been.
That was a whole actually scene. Like that entire scene was just a symphony of actuallys.
And like in the recent, you know, in our recent cultural context, like actually is supposed to be this like mansplainy thing. But it really, I think, does derive like in a non-gendered aspect from like just college know-it-all like liberal kids.
Yeah.
Like kind of actually it's not, it's, I'm sure that men do it more or whatever. But like to me, I was like, this is just a perfectly written character. This Meadow kind of being like, actually, mom, who never finished college, I've learned because I've read some books.
Yeah.
And
it's like when they're kind of in a situation where they're with people who are really wealthy or really upper class, like the Carmela is always so tense in those moments, I think.
Yeah, she is. You know, a few times in the series, like, she shows kind of like open discomfort towards like, I guess towards like bowing to people who are supposed to be higher up on the totem pole. Well, like she got really.
I mean, that was like my experience at Columbia too, where you're just like hanging out.
I can imagine.
You think you're all peers, and then suddenly someone's like an Infanta de Gracia, and you're like, well, shit. I didn't even know what that was until 5 minutes ago. And here we are.
Yeah, and here I am impressed with it.
Exactly.
Right, and Tony doesn't give a fuck about that kind of shit, but Carmela definitely is bothered by it, I think.
Yeah. Because to her, like, a lot of that stuff is just, it is kind of like this suburban keeping up with the Joneses type thing, where she's like, that's why she wanted Meadow to go to an Ivy League school.
And she wants to fancy herself a reader, like Carmela.
Yes. Yeah.
I always like that character detail
about her. Yeah. Yeah, she's always, you know, reading a book. I'd enjoy it more if the book always was a romance novel and the cover of it was a guy who looked like Furio. Yeah. But anyways, so Carmela, you know, goes to a birthday dinner under Eloise's portrait with Meadow and continues having this like drawn out fight with Meadow in which she's just like, you know. She's mad at Meadow for like being in love with Finn, and Meadow's also being a total prick because like she's like, are you just mad because you're old and your pussy's all dried up and daddy's dick doesn't work and you guys just mash parts but nothing can happen, you know? She says something along those lines, and it's funny because like at first you're not on Carm's side because you're like, come on, Carmela, like it's your daughter's birthday, get over it. But then Meadow always just takes it eight steps too far.
I think that's like Meadow's stage in life, is I think you sort of like the first step towards adulthood is realizing that you can like say something mean to your parents and the barbs will actually land. Like she just like watched one thing that she said like actually land for once, and it's sort of like novel at that stage of life, I feel like.
That's weird to me. I don't relate to that at all. Like, there's never been a time where I couldn't hurt my parents' feelings.
Like, yeah, but maybe you don't notice it when you're younger. Like when
I would notice it a lot. I would do my best to like keep them like happy and not, because whenever I would accidentally hurt my parents' feelings, I'd hear about it. Mm. Like, a few days later I'd be like, why is mom not talking to me? And and then she would like, you know, tell me later that I hurt her feelings. Anyways, point is like, it like there's just a type of kid who is mean to their parents that I've never been able to relate to, because I'm always like, I've always felt like my parents were more fragile than I am.
Also, like, Meadow thinks she's doing like a tough love thing, like,
yeah,
in a way, and it is just mean the way she does it. But I do feel like she thinks she's like pushing her mom to like live her life for herself in a way, but it just never works.
Well, she's also like the perfect like neoliberal, where like the way like you have to identify like racism and homophobia in society, and then scold the people out of it, or like be mean to them until they don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, for her, like, her finger wagging is like a magic wand. Uh-huh. And she's just like, if I tell my mom that she is a horrible backwards traditionalist, then maybe that'll, like, spur her to, like, you know, get better or whatever. But it never works. And then, of course, they get into this fight. Meadow has no idea what's going on until she visits AJ. And they have a little meeting between the two of them in which Meadow is like asking AJ, what's happening with our mom's mood? You know, she seems like she's kind of in a bad mood. And I have another
perfectly written scene that really perfectly written and perfectly constructed, that very like very much contrasts with the golf scene and a couple of others.
Where's mom?
Bed, I guess.
She seemed weird to you lately.
How?
Angry. Sad?
I guess she's been crying a lot.
Since when?
Last week. I think she's upset about Furio's dad.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, he died, and I think Furio went back to Italy or something. And she was going over there a lot.
To Furio's?
She was helping him decorate. And she made me go, too. It was really a pain in the ass.
She took you there? More than once?
I don't know. A couple, three times. Oh, dude. Meeting's over.
Jesus.
I mean, that's just perfect and classic Sopranos writing to just, you know, have this heart to heart and then end it with a fart joke.
It's rare that you have a button at the end of a scene like a fart that can work in the context of the character.
Yeah.
So it's just it's fucking perfect. And just like the abruptness of meeting over.
Meeting over. Don't you wish you could do that at actual work?
I mean, it's kind of
like you're having a talk with your boss and you just fart on him like, eh, meeting over, dude. Sorry.
Uh-oh.
TikTok.
Meeting over. I shit myself. Oh, no. That's how I would do it. Yeah, no. And that's, you know, kind of a, I would say, a little, it's low-key allegorical to the episode. The abrupt, you know, fart
well,
meeting over.
Well, he's a very allegorical guy.
He's very allegorical. I mean, you know, you've got, that's exactly what Furio did. He farted and was like, meeting over, you know? And that was it. And yeah, and so then we got to get into this Pauly and Nucci storyline.
Almost always the best storyline is Pauly's. Yes. I mean, if there's a Pauly storyline, chances are it's going to be the best one.
Just, it's because, that's the thing. When it was just Pauly alone, obviously it was good. Very much enjoyed. When it's Pauly and Nucci together, honestly, I could watch that all day. I think that's a spinoff I would watch.
Yeah, she has this incredible style where, like, when she's doing her lines, it sounds like she's reading off a teleprompter, but for some reason, like, it works perfectly for that character. Like, she doesn't. She has weird inflections, and she seems to like ignore punctuation in her lines, and it makes complete sense to her for whatever reason.
I like all older actors to be really bad. Like, I
yes,
it makes it funnier to be realistic in a way. Like, it works.
Yeah, it adds more to the character because you feel like you make excuses for very, very old actors sounding strange because you're like,
because old people do old. They do sound strange.
Yeah, they've lived 80 years. What do they need commas and semicolons for?
Yeah.
And so we start out with, like, Nucci is in the car with the Golden Girls, Min and Cookie, just jabbering on about fucking nothing.
Talking past each other like ships in the night.
Honestly, it's just beautiful Italian blathering that, like, that leads to a car accident.
This was great to watch for me.
I was like, where the hell is this going? Like, when that scene first appeared, I was like, what's going on here? Why am I seeing this? Like,
right. Yeah, which was great for me to watch because I got backed into in a parking lot this past week. So it was nice to see that happen.
Bummer, dude.
On screen, yeah.
It happens, man. But yeah, so... Min gets into this car accident. They end up, you know, Pauly shows up to, you know, scold Min for driving, you know.
By the way, what do we think Min is short for?
I know this.
Minestrone?
Yeah.
This is my grandmother, Minestrone.
Minestrone! Yeah, what I feel like I knew.
Maybe it's something like Minna or Wilhelmina or like I don't know.
What is like Mindy? Is Mindy short for anything? Is Minnie or Mindy short for a longer name?
Yeah, it must be, right? I mean, I don't know. I know that she's Minnie Matrone, right? Or Min Matrone. It's
Mini
it's
Minestrone. Matron. Hey, it's a me, a Minestrone. Like, she's the ambassador to the UN or something.
Yeah. Ambassador Minestrone has the floor. Yeah, so Min is a wonderful character we've been introduced to this season who you know, Min and Cookie both hate Nucci, but are forced to hang out with her on the threat of, I assume, death of their children.
Yeah.
Or at least physical discomfort.
Cookie is like, she's just like the, you know, the old lady who you kind of respect her. Like she's just aged past the time when she needs to care about, when she needs to put up with fools. Whereas like Min is just kind of an old bitch.
Yeah.
Min has very like throw mama from the train vibe, like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. And yeah, like fucking, you know, Pauly has been trying to engineer this friendship between all three of them like at the end of the barrel of a gun, which is the funniest way to create the Golden Girls. Like, imagine if the Golden Girls were forced to be friends because one of them had a crazy son with a gun pointed at their heads. And you know, Polly is like, you know, don't worry, I'll drive you, you know, and because they've got tickets to the producers, which is very of that time.
I remember his entirely performative mom love, where he always has to make a big show about how much he loves his mother.
His performative mom love is what makes his character like even better to me, because it's real, but it is also performative at the same time for the people around her. So it's like he is dedicated to his mother. But he also wants people to know that he's a good son.
Yeah, he's more dedicated to people thinking that he's dedicated to his
mother. I think
he's
equally dedicated to both.
Right.
I think he both is that and wants credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like very social media vibe where you are a good person, but you also want everyone to know what mm-hmm. you've done.
Yeah.
To just do it in private.
Yeah, very much. I love my Asian wife. And you're just like, all right, dude, like, why are you doing this? You know, the people online, they like to let people know that they are good people. Yeah. And it's kind of we've always said Polly is this very online character in a way. Like he represents the kind of like black and white world of online, where he's just like, he's always the most angry, the most willing to be like, fuck that person forever for any infraction.
Right. Over one state, like one tweet.
Yeah. Yeah. Polly is the embodiment of mafia cancel culture. So it's so he's perfect in multiple ways. But yeah, so then there's this great scene where he has driven them all to a restaurant, or he's driven them into the city to see the producers, and then they're all sitting around.
I mean, imagine being so dedicated to looking like you're a good son that you're willing to drive a group of old ladies to the theater. Whew.
Yeah. No, I think that's real dedication. I think that is real love. Like, he's protective. He doesn't want Minnie to fucking get into a car accident with his... Right. His little weak ass mom. I love this scene so much, because it just, it ends with Polly kind of like taking control of the cut of who gets the roles. and I have a clip of that.
I like to have the money right in my hands.
Still keep it under the mattress?
Never you mind where I keep it. I need change.
Where's my rolls?
I don't know, Ma.
Waiter.
These Parker House rolls, they belong to my Ma.
They do not. They were for the table.
Wrap these up, will you? Cellophane.
That poor waiter.
I know.
You know the clip was shit, like, first of all. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was probably the most difficult table ever. And I absolutely love any moment where I get to see how cheap Polly is. Like,
yes,
it's always hilarious.
It's so funny.
He's so Al Pacino, like trying to get the money out of the parking meter in Donnie Brasco. That's like Polly's entire life. Then that poor waiter has to deal with getting a shitty old lady tip, getting snapped at by Polly, and then demanding that he wrap up the rolls, and also getting told the material that he must wrap up the fucking dinner rolls in.
Cellophane. So fucking fun. And imagine being snapped at by Polly.
And the guy's immediately. Like, cellophane? Is that even like a thing that exists anymore?
It's such an old word choice.
Yeah.
Like, it's just... Also, her with her breaking her $100 bill, you know that took forever.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. And then also, we get a little hint.
I had flashbacks to getting like a $100 bill when I worked as a waiter. And then, you know, having to walk all the way into the hotel to break the thing because they didn't give us enough money in the cash register. And hearing the old man mutter to himself, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. He literally muttered it like... 30 times that I could hear him while I was going to break the fucking $100 bill.
My God. Yeah. I mean, you know, breaking money, nobody enjoys it.
And you're it's not me. I would give you the change if I had it. I have to walk all the way to the hotel for this. I'm sorry.
But we do learn a little bit more about Min's kind of financial situation, in that like she keeps her money under her mattress, which is important because we're now at a point with Pauly's storyline where he's convinced himself over this past season that he and Johnny Sack are real good friends and that that Johnny Sack talks to Carmine about him all the time.
We'll see. Yeah, Pauly's fundamental misunderstanding is that he thinks the mob is about relationships and not strictly about money. So he thinks that, like, by being buddies with all these other mafia guys, that he has created a higher value for himself. When in reality, like, no one gives a fuck. Like, Silvio tells him, you're only as good as your last envelope. And I will say, like, this episode, when I watched it the second time, I noticed how much they foreshadowed certain things. Like, there's the courtroom scene where, like, Bobby Bacala is narrowing his eyes and seeing the juror's, like, wedding ring, and then the wheels are turning, like, oh, this guy's got, like, a wife and family, and we can probably get to this guy. And sort of Pauly doing the same thing in the dinner when Min is talking about where she keeps all of her cash, and she has all these cash assets, and he's like, oh, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, I will file that for later.
I know where my next envelope's coming from.
He has that great scene with Syl in which she's like, nobody knows what the future holds, my friend.
You're a wormy cocksucker, you know that?
No! I'm just telling you how you're being fucking perceived. Just worry about how you're fucking perceived. Nobody knows what the future holds, my friend.
You know, and
my favorite line in that is Silvio getting mad and going, I'm just trying to tell you how you're being fucking perceived, like, which is a great line because no one has ever wanted someone to tell them how they're being perceived, because the other person's thing is like, look, I'm just being devil's advocate about how bad of a person you are here. Right. I'm not the bad guy, even though all of these observations are coming directly out of my own brain and from nowhere else.
Yeah.
It's the word choice of perceived to so hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, it's very careful and very consigliere like, where he's like, I'm not telling you a reflection of the reality of the situation. I'm telling you how it could be interpreted by other parties.
Yeah. You insult them a little bit. I don't know. Yeah. Not for nothing.
Yeah. Of course, Pauly's not hearing it until he randomly decides to go to a wedding of his third cousin or whatnot. Yeah. And he goes there to engineer a situation in which he talks to Carmine. And goes up to Carmine, and Carmine is like, who the fuck are you? And what does he say? Oh, yeah, your father was run over by a milk truck.
A trolley.
Yeah, by a trolley. Just the idea where he's like, oh, the context I have for you is your father was killed by a trolley. Just like the fucking the beauty of adding that to the backstory of Pauly.
Yeah.
Just like expand the Pauly universe, please.
Yeah, you know he's been living that down for his whole life.
Yes. Like, yeah. His like whole life, his whole existence is like avoid trolleys at all costs.
It reminds me of my great grandfather who fell out of the tree while trying to watch a concert in Golden Gate Park. And
did he die?
Yeah, that's how he died. And
sorry.
Also like a great uncle that I had who was an electrician who like somehow electrocuted himself in a house that he was doing.
That makes more sense. I could see that.
Yeah. But I feel like those could be Pauly's family members as well. Like, hey, aren't you the guy whose father fell out of the tree while he was trying to watch the concert?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's you. Pauly reacts to that knowing full well that his entire like vision of himself, the way he has perceived himself, is based on a lie told by Johnny Sack.
I like that he literally looks in the mirror like,
who am I? other than a very handsome man, who am I?
starts playing from Milan.
Turns out I was just a beautiful pair of fenders this whole time.
This immediately leads to Pauly's next scene, in which he is breaking into Minnie Matrone's house that she lives in alone.
Yeah.
Checking under the mattress. And I have that clip.
What are you doing?
Man, your door was open. I bought you something for my ma.
What are you doing?
Calling your mother. You got any coffee?
You're here to rob me.
No, no. What are you, crazy? Just calm down, okay?
You're a disgrace to your mother.
Don't set that thing off. You think I'm here to hurt you?
You know me since I'm a kid.
Help!
What are you doing?
Help! Help!
Man, wait!
You were always a little bastard!
Shut up with that fucking mop!
Again, Sopranos ADR guy and Foley operator, just like unmatched. So many good things about that scene.
That scene is so fucking perfect.
From the fact that he stubs his toe on the way to go kill the old lady.
From the fact that he stops her from hitting her life alert button.
Yeah. To the line, shut up with that fucking mouth.
Yes.
Great line. And then just the look on her face after when he takes the pillow off and she's got like... you never get a realistic face of a dead person in a show. They're always either like too peaceful or too horrified, where like they really just made her like, yeah, her eyes are like kind of half open and she has a really dumb look on her face. Yeah. Like that feels very accurate to what a corpse actually looks like.
I heard a funny trivia, like a fun fact about this scene is that Tony initially was supposed to strangle her, but he thought it made him look bad, and that's why they smothered her with a pillow. That's better. Like,
no, I mean, I think he read the room right in that case, because there is something about like in the moment he is trying to shut her up, and kind of like, I don't know, there's something about like the callback of smothering someone with a pillow, which was something that people claimed that Tony was trying to do with his mother.
Just,
I don't know what it is about that. It seems like
he'd be more, I mean, you'd have more plausible deniability if you smothered someone with a pillow than if they had like fingerprint marks around their neck. Although, I don't know that smothering a person with a pillow is a thing that is possible in real life. It's a thing that happens in movies a lot. I don't know that that is...
I feel like it's more possible if they're comatose or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yes. Yeah. You
know, when they're fighting back, it seems a little harder.
Yeah.
But I've never tried it, but you know, I could see it working.
I mean, you're still getting a little bit of...
Maybe.
Yeah, a baby for sure.
You're still getting like a little bit of oxygen through that pillow, like as opposed to, you know, when you cut off someone's...
I don't think you're getting much.
Well, when you cut off someone's circulation, like they go out like that. Yeah, but with air, it takes way longer.
Yeah, no, it definitely would have taken longer. This is definitely one of those things where it was like, you know, they sped up the death. Usually, The Sopranos is good with taking a while to savor it.
But I think they were a little bit like between like 2 to 5 minutes to actually smother someone with a pillow.
I also just love the moment, like visually, with her slippers coming in when he was under the bed.
Yes.
The person, you know, it's like, oh fuck, like he's not leaving her alone to say anything. Like, going down. It's like,
shit, boned.
They also made her so unlikable that you're kind of rooting for Polly to steal her money in that scene.
They engineered the scene to really give Min this awesome ending where, you kind of want her to die because she's just such a horrible person. But, I mean, you know, she's the old lady that you always have fantasized about smothering with a pillow.
But you also respect her a little bit because, like, she clearly knows that this guy's going to kill her, but she refuses to play nice with him. She's like, no, I'm
no
still
filter
for her life. She calls him like a bastard.
You're a disappointment to your mother. And then like, I also really love the pillows fully over the face and then the, oh no. Like, it's rare that I laugh at a scene it's where great. An old lady is killed, but
oh no, with a pillow over your face.
Oh amazing. No, with a pillow over the face. Like, I'm doomed. Like, that is just, oh, that is so funny.
I
that
think
is
the just, funny thing about Polly is that he doesn't talk nicer if someone's an old lady, or do you know what I mean? He doesn't have any sense of politeness.
He talks softer, but he still says mean things.
Yeah.
It's like the funniest thing is like meeting people on their level is just a question of what tone of voice he uses,
right,
but
he's
always saying something horrible.
Yeah.
It's so fucking funny, you know? Then Polly goes over, takes the money. I assume not all of it, but a big portion of the money that he's stolen from Min, and gives it to Tony as a way to...
He always keeps a little. Like, he always...
Of course.
He's definitely a guy who keeps the lion's share and doesn't report exactly how much income. Yeah. Like, this dude is, he has never been honest about any cut, unless he's been forced to be. So that's his way of getting back to the good graces with Tony. And then also, you know, when Johnny Sack calls and Tony's like, I gotta take this. He's like, what is that piece of shit want? And then we end on Johnny Sack being like, I think we should do something really spectacular for the season finale. And Tony's like, really? And then it ends.
The way he says, holy shit. Like, it's like the audience's reaction or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it is definitely a twist in that I remember thinking to myself, like, uh-oh. But in retrospect, knowing how things kind of, like, play out, you know, you just kind of... you get to see Johnny Sack go from the kind of, like, Tony's best friend from New York, you know, the guy who's always, like, kind of being fair to him into the Johnny Sack of later Sopranos lore. And it's great. But those are episodes for another day. I think in terms of favorite, least favorite scene, if I had to think of a favorite scene, I would say it is it's Minnie Matrone being smothered by a pillow. Least favorite scene, I don't know, probably... the scenes where Tony goes up to Johnny Sack and is like, this isn't what we agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And whenever they get too into the weeds with the mafia stuff, I always find I'm like the least interested in that kind of thing. I like the emotional journey that these characters take. But that's just me. I mean, you know, some people like mafia doing mafia stuff, not me. Let's see, Vince, do you have a favorite, least favorite?
Yeah, I mean, I love Polly stubbing his toes in the middle of a murder. And least favorite, I've already said it, is the whole golf sequence at the beginning, which was just trying to do way too much and also poorly structured.
Desi, do you have like a favorite scene?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go with the Min death as well, just because... I love comedy with Polly. Like, his scenes are always so funny. I also just love the line where Carmela says, Sonny Bono, like, about skiing. I don't know why that made me laugh, just because it was so, like, what? Like, that's her one skiing reference. Like, but least favorite scene, I mean, I'd have to go, I'll try to pick something different. Just the scenes with Furia where nothing happens. It ended up being kind of frustrating. Like, there wasn't even, like, an age of innocence. Like, touch of skin or something, like, sort of escalated. And I felt like that could have even worked if they just brushed against each other or something.
I don't know. Instead, we're constantly edging the whole time and there's no release.
Half the point of that being interesting.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally agree. I would just real quick say that I have a favorite. It's not a favorite quote because there's so many good fucking quotes in this episode, but it's just a very funny moment that I love The Sopranos does, where Vito says of I forget it was Johnny or Sack or whatever, but Vito says he put on an Emmy caliber performance.
Oh yeah,
and I just love when The Sopranos shits on the accolades that they have received. Like later we're going to meet JT, who is like this this TV writer who is in the program with Chris. You just see the way they talk about people who write for TV or the awards that television people get. And there's so much derision there. And I love it so much because I picture David Chase behind the cameras of a TV show, not living his dream of being a movie guy. and just like, honestly, treating the fans and treating the whole process the same way we do with podcasting, where we're just like, time to feed the fucking piggies all their slop. You know, just I love that about David Chase. Just always breaking the balls of other people who work in television. So big shout out to that. I think if I had to rate this episode with like a letter grade, probably, yeah, I would give it a solid B+. Vince, what would you give this episode?
I mean, tough one. A lot of good stuff. A couple bad scenes. Overall, I think like a really solid B+.
Yeah. Desi, if you had to rate this episode with a letter grade, it could be any letter grade, obviously.
Well, I'm going to take some points off for the golf scene, so I'm going to give it a B+, I think.
Mm.
Okay, that's fair. That sounds like a fair grade for The Sopranos.
Well thought out.
Thought out and totally fair. And it has been a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself a Gun. Desi, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, where can people find you on the internet?
Just at Desi Jed and on Twitter, and then my podcast, Hollywood Crime Scene.
Yeah. Check out Hollywood Crime Scene if you haven't already. It is a great podcast. Both of the hosts are excellent. You will love it. Patreon.com/Frotcast for all of the bonus episodes in which we talk about other things that aren't just The Sopranos. The $8 tier is the Pod Yourself a Shout Out tier. And Vince, I hope you got your mafia name cap on.
I do.
Because last week we did the mailbag episode. We didn't do the Pod Yourself a Shout Out patrons. So we have 2 weeks worth. So are you ready? We've got a few names that you're going to have to give mafia names to.
Sure.
All right. These are our $8 patrons, starting with Ryan Soper.
Hey, the soup. We call him Chowder.
Oh, all right. Ryan Chowder Soper. All right. Next, we have Steve Batezel.
I think it's Batezel. We're going to call him the Tees.
Oh, Batezel. That makes more sense than Batezel.
The Tees.
Yeah, Steve the Tease. He's a cock tease. Kevin Giesbrecht?
I don't know.
Giesbrecht.
Sounds German, so we're going to call him the Germ.
All right, Kevin the Germ. That's pretty good. Seth Wallace.
Oh, Seth Wallace.
We call him Freedom.
We call him Stinky Seth. No, we call him the Funk because he's so stinky.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I don't even know how you got there, but I like
it.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
Then we have Michael James Benson.
Oh, bitch. The Michael James Benson. But Benson, that's a butler's name, isn't it? We're calling him Mikey the Butler.
Mikey the Butler. Mm-hmm. Then David Soda.
Soda, come on, that's not even a real name.
I think it might be.
Yeah, we'll call him Coke. Coke
all
can.
Right, David.
The Coke can.
Coke can. All
right. There we go. Sure.
We call him High Fructose Corns, David. All right. Two more left. We have Shell Shoe. I don't know if this is a real name.
Shell Shoe? Oh, that's not a real name. Shoe.
Well, Shell. Yeah.
The foot will be big foot. We call him Sasquatch.
Sasquatch, Shell Shoe. And finally, Chris Miller.
Chris Miller, isn't he the famous director? We're going to call this guy Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
That's such a long name.
We'll call him the Meatball.
We'll call him the Meatball. Chris, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Miller. And Ryan, Steve, Kevin, Seth, Michael, David, and Shell, thank you so much for being the $8 Pod Yourself a Shout-Out patrons. And you can do it, too, if you're listening. And, yeah, patreon.com/frogcast. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, concerns. Vince, what's the Google voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everybody. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.